Today is Wednesday, January 6th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Voters in the southern U.S. state of Georgia went to the polls on Tuesday. The outcome will determine control of the Senate, an election that could also bring about some firsts.
John Ossoff, who, if he is indeed elected as the Democratic senator from Georgia, would be the youngest U.S. senator in more than 40 years.
Plus, the Gulf Cooperation Council held its 41st annual summit and how the pandemic affects press freedom in China. We'll have these stories and more next. Tuesday is election day for two runoff U.S. Senate races in the state of Georgia. That will determine whether Republicans or Democrats control the power in the U.S. Senate. VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson is in Dalton, Georgia, covering the race.
Yeah, well, we all, of course, know that 3 million Georgians have already headed to the polls in early voting, and that good turnout really seemed to be keeping up today in the suburbs of Atlanta, Georgia, where I was at some polling locations that were definitely packed. Some of them at various times of the day have lines out the door. I did observe some issues with people not getting their precincts right. There were some shifting of precincts since the November presidential election. A lot of people very frustrated about that they had to go to a different polling station or use provisional ballots. And I also heard from some voters that they were concerned that the voting machines themselves were not being used. I think there's been so much of the nation's attention on this issue of voting fraud allegations in Georgia that everyone is very aware of that as they head to the polls today.
Now, Catherine, we have spent a lot of time talking about the election mechanism in Georgia, the recounts, the challenges by the Trump administration. But one thing we haven't talked about is who's running. And I understand there's actually going to be potentially some firsts depending on who's elected.
That's right. So we have two Senate runoff races, not one, but two. It's pretty unprecedented. We've really never been in this situation before. In the first race, we have the young John Ossoff, who, if he is indeed elected as the Democratic senator from Georgia, would be the youngest U.S. senator in more than 40 years. That would, of course, happen only if he beats the Republican incumbent Senator David Perdue, who is currently in quarantine because he was exposed to a COVID-19 positive case recently and has been taken off the campaign trail. Over on the other Senate race, we have Kelly Loeffler, who is running against Reverend Raphael Warnock, who, of course, is the pastor of the church that was once headed by Martin Luther King Jr., a very famous church here in Georgia and in the Atlanta area.
Now, polls are closing on Tuesday night, but when are election results expected to be announced?
That's the question that everybody here in Georgia is wondering about. You know, we had so much attention and focus on the recount here in Georgia in the presidential election that I think that all of these state officials are going to want to dot every I, cross every T, count every single vote. And of course, they also have ballots coming in from overseas, from military members. We're hearing that that probably won't happen until the end of the week. Because the polls in these races have been showing that they're so close, they may need every vote to be counted to decide this one. So I would not hold out hopes to have a result tonight when those polls close.
Catherine Gibson is VOA's congressional correspondent. Britain entered another strict national lockdown on Tuesday amid a sudden and sharp resurgence in cases of COVID-19 linked to a new variant of the coronavirus. Henry Ridgewell takes it from here.
Britain's elementary schools had only reopened for the new term. By the evening, Prime Minister Boris Johnson had reversed course, announcing a third national lockdown.
The government is once again instructing you to stay at home.
So schools and universities are closed. Anne Longfield is Children's Commissioner for England.
It is something which will have a deep impact on children, a deep impact on their well-being and mental health.
The lockdown comes amid warnings that hospitals are being overwhelmed. The number of people hospitalised with COVID-19 is 40% higher than at the spring peak. total deaths have risen above 75,000. The new variant, the coronavirus, identified in southern Britain in September, is up to 70% more infectious and is spreading across the country. Dr. Dominic Spray, Clinical Director of Adult Critical Care at St. George's Hospital in London.
We have people in their 40s, their 30s, their 20s on our intensive care unit dying of COVID. We are having to think about whether we do cancer surgery. We're having to postpone cancer surgery because of the number of COVID patients we have in.
Chloe Pitch, a senior nurse at St. George's Hospital, says staff morale is suffering.
It's been one of the worst shifts of my entire life. Intense. I'm looking after many more sick patients than I normally look after. It's just overwhelming, the whole situation.
Once again, the government must respond to an escalating health emergency and a resurgent economic crisis as non-essential shops and services are forced to close. The government announced one-off grants of up to $12,200 for businesses, but hundreds of them have already closed for good. Gary Marshall is owner of Bevington Salads, which supplies the hospitality industry.
The lockdowns, the tier systems, etc., especially to the hospitality sector, have had a tremendous effect, an astronomical effect on the industry. It's really, really in a bad place.
But this time there is one big difference. Britain began mass vaccinations using the Oxford University AstraZeneca jab Monday. Already, 1 million people have received the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine. The government aims to inoculate 2 million people every week from Monday. In his televised address, Prime Minister Johnson told the British public there is hope on the horizon.
If deaths start to fall as the vaccine takes effect, and critically, if everyone plays their part by following the rules, then I hope we can steadily move out of lockdown.
That could happen by March if the vaccinations go to plan. But the government warns the coming weeks will be the hardest yet since the pandemic began. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, the head of the World Health Organization, on Tuesday said that he was disappointed Chinese officials had not finalized permissions for the arrival of a team of experts into China to examine the origins of COVID-19.
I have once again made it clear that the mission is a priority for WHO and the international team. I have been assured that China is speeding up the internal procedure for the earliest possible deployment.
Members of the international team had set out on their journey to China, where the outbreak of the virus was first reported late last year in the city of Wuhan in the past 24 hours, and were due to start working earlier on Tuesday. China has denied trying to cover up its association with the pandemic that emerged in late 2019 and has infected over 86 million people worldwide. The International Organization for Migration warns that conditions continue to deteriorate for thousands of migrants, refugees, and asylum seekers stranded in Bosnia as politicians fail to reach a solution to alleviate their plight. Lisa Schlein has more.
About 6,000 migrants are housed in official accommodation centers in Bosnia. Nearly 3,000 other migrants, including women and children, are sleeping outdoors in Unasana Canton on the border with Croatia. The International Organization for Migration says about half of those people are squatting under substandard conditions in abandoned buildings. Another 1,400, mainly single men, who had been living in the Lipa emergency tent camp were forced to leave after the camp burned down. They've been living outdoors in bitterly cold temperatures and frequent rainy conditions for the past 2 weeks. IOM Bosnia Chief of Mission Peter van der Auerert says the situation is not sustainable. Speaking on a video link from the Bosnian capital, Sarajevo, he says there actually is space in two official centers that could shelter all the people currently sleeping outside.
What has been impossible is to get a consensus between the central government, which are at least nominally in charge of dealing with this issue, and the local authorities where these two centers are located to allow migrants access to the center. There is international funding available. There is international assistance available. What has been the difficulty is to get a political consensus as to where these migrants could be accommodated.
Auerert says most of the migrants, refugees and asylum seekers come from Pakistan, Bangladesh, Afghanistan, Algeria and Morocco. He says most use Bosnia as a transit route through Croatia and Slovenia to get to the European Union. He says their presence has generated hostility and anti-migrant sentiments among some local authorities and populations.
Finally, I think there is some issues in terms of the media here in Bosnia-Herzegovina highlighting mostly negative stories about migrants. But I also think we need to be very careful not to overplay the anti-migrant and refugee sentiment in Bosnia-Herzegovina. Clearly, there's a minority of people that is very vocal on social media, but there is a consensus, I believe, amongst the majority of people that while they're here, they should be treated humanely.
The IOM official says urgent action is needed to end the political impasse and alleviate the suffering of the migrants. While their physical health is degrading, he also notes signs that the situation also is taking a serious toll on their mental health. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And coming up later...
The pandemic has overshadowed what I think is the most disturbing trend or development this year, which has actually been the situation in Hong Kong, because I think it's an example of the sort of larger struggle between... liberal societies in which press freedom is respected as a basic value and a more authoritarian model of society in which the press is understood as a vessel of government messaging.
This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Results of a randomized controlled trial provides evidence that infusions of mesenchymal stem cells from umbilical cords can safely lessen the threat of death and hasten the recovery time for patients with severe COVID-19. Mesenchymal stem cells, according to the National Cancer Institute, are cells that develop into connective tissue, blood vessels, and lymphatic tissue. The trial was led by researchers at the University of Miami's Miller School of Medicine. 24 COVID-19 patients with severe acute respiratory distress syndrome, one of the disease's main causes of death, were given two infusions, days apart of each other, of either stem cells or placebos. The researchers report that 91% of those treated with stem cells, compared to 42% who got the placebos, were still alive after 1 month and recovered faster from the disease. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. The Gulf Cooperation Council held its 41st annual summit outside the Saudi capital of Riyadh Tuesday amid optimism over the apparent resolution of long-standing conflicts with Qatar. Riyadh has agreed to reopen its land, sea, and air borders with Doha. Edward Uranian has that story.
Qatari TV showed the country's leader, Sheikh Tamim bin Hamad Al Thani, being met at the airport in Riyadh and embraced by longtime adversary Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman in the lead-up to Tuesday's Gulf Cooperation Summit in the Saudi province of Al Ula. The Saudi Crown Prince, who chaired the summit, thanked allies and friends of the kingdom for mediating with Qatar over many months to bring about the resumption of relations at the Tuesday summit. He says that he thanks the late Emir of Kuwait, Sheikh Sabah Al Ahmed Al Sabah, and the current Emir, Sheikh Nawaf Al Ahmed Al Sabah, as well as allies like the United States, for mediating the Al Ula agreement with Qatar that is now being signed to forge stability and solidarity in the Gulf. Saudi Arabia reopened its land, sea, and air borders with Qatar as a result of the agreement, and Arab media showed the reopened border checkpoint between the two countries. It did not appear, however, that much, if any, traffic was moving in either direction. Up to 800 trucks carrying food and other supplies normally go through the crossing every day. Qatari analyst Majid Al Ansari told the country's Al Jazeera TV Arabic that he does not think there has been any resolution of most demands made on Qatar by any of the four countries which closed their borders to Doha in 2017, but that conflict management would address the outstanding grievances. Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Bahrain and the United Arab Emirates closed their borders to Qatar in 2017 over the country's alleged support of terrorist groups, hostile media campaigns against them by Al Jazeera TV, support for the Muslim Brotherhood group, and the Emirates' ties with Iran. Egyptian political sociologist Saeed Sadiq says neither Egypt nor the UAE are pleased about the normalization with Qatar, since none of the irritants with Doha have been resolved.
And Egypt had no other option but to coordinate.
What is to be done. They went along with the decision, but with the following understanding: because Qatar did not deliver, Sisi refused to attend the summit and sent his foreign minister, Sama Shukri. Washington-based Gulf analyst Theodore Karasik says the Trump administration pushed all sides to reopen because it's critical for regional rejuvenation due to the COVID-19 crisis. Saudi Arabia, he adds, offers ports to help export or import for Qatar, but the scope is bigger because it involves dealing with Iran and Turkey. And in the background, he argues, is the normalization process between the UAE and Israel. Paul Sullivan, a professor at Washington-based National Defense University, says it was just a matter of time before the GCC countries would find some accommodation for Qatar to rejoin, but that it may also be a matter of time before past tensions resurface, including allegations of Qatar's support for terrorism, relations with the Muslim Brotherhood, which the Saudis and Emiratis consider a threat, and Doha's cordial ties with Iran. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
The United States has sanctioned entities and individuals associated with Iran's steel industry, the latest move in a U.S. pressure campaign against Tehran in the waning days of U.S. President Donald Trump's administration. The U.S. Treasury Department said in a statement that it blacklisted more than a dozen entities and one person. The sanctions were imposed on the Chinese-owned Kaifeng Pingmei New Carbon Materials Technology Company Limited, which is a manufacturer of carbon materials that are key elements in steel production. The Treasury Department said the company sold materials and equipment to a steel company in Iran through an Iranian trading firm between December of 2019 and June of 2020. The company was targeted for, quote, having materially assisted, sponsored, or provided financial, material, or technological support for, or goods or services in support of Iranian steelmaker Pasargad Steel Complex, end quote. Relations between the United States and the nations on the African continent have never been more interesting or more critical. In part one of our two-part series, we focused on the incoming administration of President-elect Joe Biden and what his foreign policy may be regarding aid, security, and other important factors. Now, today, we take a look at the role that China, which is increasingly powerful on the continent, might play in America's relationships in Africa going forward. VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with John Campbell, the Ralph Bunche Fellow for Africa Policy Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations in Washington. He's also a former U.S. ambassador to Nigeria. Ambassador Campbell began their conversation by commenting on how the early days of the pandemic in Africa appeared through American eyes.
When COVID first arrived in Africa, Africa watchers, including certainly me, were deeply concerned that with a weak public health sector, the disease would be particularly virulent in Africa. It has not proven to be so.
Why do you suppose that's the case?
I think there is American admiration for some of the public health initiatives taken by various African states. Take, for example, the closure of borders and the shutting down of internal movements. in a continent in which much enterprise is conducted on a face-to-face basis. Some African states, I'm thinking here specifically of South Africa, have also been particularly nimble, both in imposing restrictions, but then lifting restrictions and then reimposing them depending on the particular circumstances.
Switching gears now to geopolitics for the moment, China, as we all know, has become a huge player in Africa. How does that fact relate to American interests in Africa vis-a-vis politics, diplomacy, and especially economic competition?
Well, of course, there's a good deal of rhetoric that comes out of the Trump administration along those lines, and I really don't buy it. The relationship between China and Africa benefits Africans more than we are generally willing to acknowledge. The Chinese loans to Africa, which get a lot of publicity, most of them are for infrastructure, and in most cases, they are at market rate or below. China has the second largest economy in the world. Africa has primary products to sell. A relationship between the two is natural. Instead of trying to exclude China from Africa, I think U.S. policy should aim to make Chinese policy in Africa congruent with the size of its economic stake. And in fact, there have been some examples of this. For example, the Chinese have played a positive role in the Sudan. The Chinese provide peacekeepers for certain peacekeeping missions. The point is not to exclude China, but instead to make the Chinese involvement in Africa more positive.
John Campbell is the Ralph Bunch Fellow for Africa Policy Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. He was speaking to my colleague, Adam Phillips. In a year of declining press freedom amid the global pandemic, China took the lead in media repression. VOA's press freedom editor, Jessica Jarit, has more.
Blocking information on the coronavirus pandemic, jailing bloggers, imposing restrictions on foreign journalists, and in Hong Kong, introducing a national security law resulting in high-profile arrests. China is at the forefront of government repression of media in 2020. Scott Griffin is with the International Press Institute.
The pandemic has overshadowed what I think is the most disturbing trend or development this year, which has actually been the situation in Hong Kong, because I think it's an example of the sort of larger struggle between liberal societies in which press freedom is respected as a basic value and a more authoritarian model of society in which the press is understood as a vessel of government messaging.
Beijing's actions to delay visas and restrict permits for local and foreign journalists stifled international coverage. Foreign correspondent Bill Birtles was forced to leave Beijing at short notice after police sought to question him and another Australian journalist. In December, a slew of arrests included Jimmy Lai, publisher of Hong Kong's Apple Daily, and Chinese nationals who worked for Bloomberg and the New York Times. Again, Scott Griffin.
The extension of Chinese law, in particular the national security law in Hong Kong, has led to a major press freedom crackdown already. And we are deeply concerned about this because I think that this is one of the clearest examples, in recent times in which a society that enjoyed press freedom for so many years is seeing that freedom removed, before its eyes and actually before the world's eyes.
China says it is responding to U.S. moves to restrict visas for journalists from Chinese state media. Foreign Ministry spokesperson Wang Wenbin.
The U.S., on the one hand, is boasting of freedom of journalism. On the other hand, is hindering and interfering with Chinese journalists reporting in the U.S., which hence exposes its hypocrisy of freedom of journalism.
Washington labels Chinese-run outlets as foreign missions and has limited visas in response to Beijing's treatment of foreign journalists. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo.
I regret China's decision today to further foreclose the world's ability to conduct the free press operations that, frankly, would be really good for the Chinese people. Really good for the Chinese people in these incredibly challenging global times where more information, more transparency are what will save lives.
China has a record of detaining those who criticize authorities or report on abuses of minorities, such as the Uyghurs. According to Press Freedom Watchdog, the Committee to Protect Journalists, it was the leading jailer of journalists in 2020, putting 47 behind bars. Courtney Raj is the committee's advocacy director.
This year, what we saw is that the reporting on COVID-19 and the pandemic, both the existence of the pandemic, but also then the governmental responses to the pandemic, landed journalists in China in jail. It also led to the expulsion of many foreign journalists from China.
In 2020, when access to reliable, independent news seemed more important than ever, experts fear that China's crackdown on the press may signal a troubling trend. Jessica Dreet, VOA News.
Over 50 pro-democratic activists in Hong Kong were arrested Wednesday for breaking the city's national security law in the biggest crackdown yet against the democratic opposition under the new law. The arrests in the Asian financial hub included well-known democratic figures and former lawmakers James To, Lam Chuk Ting, and Lester Shum, according to the Democratic Party's Facebook page and public broadcaster RTHK. Police did not immediately respond to a Reuters news request for comment. The Democratic Party's Facebook page said the police arrested the activists for participating in an independently organized ballot last year to select Democratic candidates for an upcoming legislature election, which the Hong Kong government and Beijing warned at the time may violate the new law. And you've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a wonderful Wednesday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
According to the United Nations, the humanitarian crisis in Yemen is the worst in the world. Yemen was already a poor country before a conflict there escalated in 2015, but the ongoing fight between the Houthis, aided and abetted by Iran, and the forces of the internationally recognized government has caused widespread devastation. As Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said in a recent statement, Iran's support for the Houthis fuels the conflict in Yemen and exacerbates the country's instability. That support is spearheaded by Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps Quds Force, the IRGC-QF, which is the Iranian regime's primary arm for executing its policy of supporting terrorist and insurgent groups. On December 8th, the United States designated Hassan Irlou, an IRGC-QF officer whom Iran recently sent to Sana'a as the regime's envoy to the Houthi rebels. As the U.S. Department of the Treasury pointed out in a statement, Iran is the only nation to officially recognize and appoint formal so-called representation to the Houthis. For years, Irlou supported IRGC-QF efforts to provide advanced weapons and training to the Houthis. Irlou maintained a relationship with former IRGC-QF commander Qasem Soleimani. He has also provided training to Hezbollah members in Iran. Secretary of State Pompeo declared that by dispatching Irlou to Yemen, the IRGC-QF is signaling its intent to increase support to the Houthis and further complicate international efforts to reach a negotiated settlement. The United States, he said, continues to support efforts to facilitate a ceasefire and political settlement. On December 8th, the United States also designated Iran-based Al-Mustafa International University for facilitating IRGC-QF recruitment efforts at its many international branches. Pakistani national Yusuf Ali Mufaj, who has been involved in the IRGC-QF efforts to plan and execute operations in the Middle East and the United States, was sanctioned as well. The IRGC-QF takes advantage of every opportunity to advance its violent and destructive agenda, including by exploiting conflicts across the Middle East and coercing vulnerable individuals to fight on behalf of the Iranian regime, said Secretary of State Pompeo. The United States will continue to use all available tools to expose and counter this malign behavior.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.